Looks like economists will be running Italy and Greece for now.
Will that do the trick?
From APM, American Public Media, in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org on this Thursday, November 10th.
Coming up, how will the European debt crisis affect different parts of the U.S.?
I'll speak with the New York Attorney General about the mortgage mess and Occupy Wall Street.
And I'll speak with the former president and CEO of Olympus about why it took so long to find out that company was covering up billions of dollars in losses.
And a Best Buy job interview turns into a Best Buy theft, Steve. Those stories ahead on Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We're going to start this morning with Greece's new prime minister-to-be. Loukas Papademos is a former Harvard University professor. He served as a vice president of the European Central Bank. And Papademos says he wants Greece to continue to use the euro and not get kicked out of the eurozone. But there are critics who say if Greece is not removed, the debt crisis will keep spreading. Christopher Worth reports now from London.
When the debt crisis began, it was just about Greece, then Ireland, then Portugal. All are relatively small economies. The thinking went Europe could handle trouble there. The bigger fear was if the contagion wasn't walled off, it could eventually infect globally significant economies like Spain and Italy. But the line was essentially drawn there. Not anymore. Worries are spreading to even bigger economies, namely France, and here's why. To some economists, the French budget deficit more resembles Ireland and Portugal's rather than Germany's. Guntram Vols is with the Brussels-based think tank Bruegel.
Certainly, France currently has a very significant deficit, much beyond the German one, and markets certainly see that difference now more clearly than a couple of years ago.
He says even if the crisis is contained before it gets to France, Italy is already big enough to doom the euro. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Another economist is likely to head a new interim government in Italy. Mario Monti is expected to be tapped as that country's new prime minister, maybe as soon as Saturday. For more, let's bring in Adolfo Laurenti, deputy chief economist with Mesirow Financial. He is with us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Adolfo, looks like economists are going to be running the show. Is this the answer to Europe's problems?
Well, this really underscores that Europe is facing political challenges even more than economic challenges. Mm. They clearly needed to improve their fiscal situation, but they also need to do structural reforms to their economies and labor markets, and that's where politicians as crucially fails. It's important to stop kicking the can down the road at this point, because the longer they wait, the worse the situation will get.
Well, you're in Washington. We're facing this deadline for the Congressional Super Committee to make cuts. A lot of people say we should kick the can down the road and not make the cuts right now. What do you make of that?
I think that would be really appropriate. We have a real advantage compared with Europe. We are not in a sovereign debt crisis yet, but that's the trajectory we are following. So I would recommend for the committee to find an agreement and really move before the pain will be too much to bear. We have already enough pain in this economy at this time.
Adolfo Laurenti with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Jeremy, Adolfo, uncertainty in Greece and Italy and even other European countries has rattled stock markets around the world. And as Europe's economy continues to sour, the blow to American trade isn't shared equally from coast to coast, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Europe is an important trade partner for the U.S., but some regions are especially exposed. Alan Berube is with the Brookings Institution.
We export almost $300 billion worth of goods and $200 billion worth of services each year to Europe. So everybody would feel Europe turning down. It's just that some places, especially on the East Coast, will feel it more than others.
Especially cities connected to the auto or drug industries.
Just look at things like pharmaceutical jobs in Indianapolis. The pace of growth in those industries not really picked up recently, I think due in part to the softness that's going on in Europe.
On the other hand, Berube says places like Allentown, Pennsylvania, are bucking the trend because of strong demand from South America. Similarly, the West Coast is somewhat insulated from Europe because it does more trade with Asia. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, the European debt crisis did find its way to Rochester, Michigan last night, sort of. That was the site of the latest presidential debate, the Republican presidential candidates, of course, debating for the nomination. The big news was that big Rick Perry oops moment that everyone has seen on YouTube at this point. But we wanted to find out how these candidates would handle the situation in Europe, and they did talk about it at the beginning of the debate. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Europe took almost as much heat as the White House last night. The candidates sounded the alarm on what's going on across the Atlantic. Texas Congressman Ron Paul said the U.S. should be paying attention. Former Utah Governor John Huntsman said we could learn a lesson from what's happening there.
If you want a window into what this country is going to look like in the future if we don't get on top of our debt, you're seeing it playing out in Europe right now.
During the CNBC-sponsored debate, none of the candidates advocated for U.S. intervention to help Europe. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney said he's not interested in bailing out any more banks, especially ones based in Europe.
There's going to be an effort to try and draw us in and talk about how we need to help help Italy and help Europe. Europe is able to help Europe.
Romney did say he's in favor of what he called world efforts, like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, organizations the U.S. helps bankroll. Businessman Herman Cain said right now, the U.S. should be focusing all its economic efforts at home. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Fewer people claimed jobless benefits last week, according to the Labor Department. That number was down 10,000 to 390,000. And that's closer to a threshold that indicates job growth in this country.
Entertainment company Viacom said today revenues were up by more than 20%. The owner of MTV, Comedy Central, and Paramount Pictures says its latest Transformers movie helped out quite a bit.
You can find out more about the numbers anytime at our website, marketplace.org.
Enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
And now to what's being billed as the largest municipal bankruptcy filing in U.S. history. It happened yesterday in Jefferson County, Alabama, my old hometown there, Jeremy. My stomping grounds. And this was a story that I've covered many times over, and a lot of journalist friends of mine, I'm sure, are knee-deep in it right now. And G.T. Duban is one of those journalists who has more now from Birmingham.
Jefferson County Manager Tony Patelis says residents shouldn't notice much difference as the county works its way through bankruptcy proceedings.
We will continue to provide the services as we have in the past. Our employees will continue to work. Their paychecks will continue to be there. Our vendors will continue to provide services to us. Our cash flow is okay.
Still, Jefferson County is staring at a $40 million hole in this year's budget. If the state legislature doesn't step in to help soon, there could be job cuts and service reductions. Meanwhile, bondholders like J.P. Morgan Chase will have to wait to find out what the bankruptcy means for them. Andreas Raudicus teaches finance at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. The county needs to come up with a reorganization plan, and a judge needs to approve it before creditors know exactly how much money they'll get back.
All of it is driven by the county. The creditors really don't have a lot of input. So all the initiative, all the plans, all the reorganization plans, everything has to come from the county, and the judge has to agree. There are no trustees in there.
Raudicus says to a big investment bank like J.P. Morgan Chase, even a $1 billion loss isn't devastating. The real problem, he says, will come when the county needs to borrow money in the future and no one wants to lend it to them. Except maybe at super high interest rates. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
RealtyTrack said this morning more homes went into foreclosure last month, meaning the mortgage mess is getting worse. As for what's being done about it, all 50 states have been looking into whether the big banks acted improperly in handling mortgages. But two state attorneys general recently decided to launch a separate investigation. That would be Delaware's Beau Biden and New York's Eric Schneiderman. I stopped by Schneiderman's office in Lower Manhattan yesterday for an interview. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman of the state of New York, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start by asking you about this investigation you're involved with into the problems that led us to the mortgage meltdown. What can you tell us about that?
Well, not a lot in detail, but Attorney General Beau Biden of Delaware and I have been working since the spring on an investigation into the conduct and circumstances that really resulted in the financial meltdown in 2007-2008. It's no secret the housing market was artificially inflated, that a lot of bad mortgages were given out, and a lot of folks bought mortgage-backed securities that are worth a lot less now than they were then. So we're looking into the circumstances to see if there's conduct that was legal but should be made illegal, and to see if there was anything illegal that contributed to the meltdown of the economy.
And as you look into this, is it worse or better or not as bad as you thought when you started out?
I guess I would say it's worse in the sense that when you appreciate the magnitude of the catastrophe, it's really pretty remarkable. Over the last 5 years, we've lost $7.4 trillion in home equity in the United States. That's where the wealth of the American middle class was. And if you want to know why there's such an increasing gap between the wealthy and everyone else, a lot of it's because people's wealth was in their homes. So the scope of the catastrophe is really remarkable. The central issue that we're encountering over and over again is that we have to restore the public's confidence that there's one set of rules for everybody. And we hear that over and over again from, I hear it from ordinary New Yorkers, and I'm sure it's true in the rest of the country. Folks don't believe there's one set of rules. They don't believe the people who caused the financial meltdown have ever been held accountable. And we have to restore public confidence that this is a nation committed to the principle of equal justice under law.
And when people look at the mortgage meltdown, some people look at it and say the banks were the ones who were the bad guys in this case. And some people look at it and say consumers, they took out loans that they couldn't afford to pay back. As you've looked into this, who is more to blame for the mortgage mess?
It's obviously a combination of things, but we are looking into origination, which is the practices by which a lot of these loans were given out. And look, there were a lot of bad, particularly at the end of this bubble, there were a lot of really bad mortgages given out to people who clearly were inappropriate to get those mortgages. And we're looking also into the securitization, the pooling of the mortgages, which were all deposited into New York and Delaware trusts, which is why Attorney General Biden and my cooperation is very, very helpful. And then the trusts were sliced up into shares of securities and sold to people, pension funds, mutual funds, governments, all over the world. So we're looking at the full range of conduct, and we hope to complete the first phase of our investigation very, very soon. The public is demanding accountability, and I think they deserve it.
One more question on this. You left the group of the other attorneys general who are looking into this mortgage mess. Why?
Well, the issue really was, and there are other AGs who have sent the same message, the multi-state negotiations that had been going on when I took office relate solely to the conduct after the market melted down, to abuses in foreclosure practices, robo-signing, things like that. The banks have been demanding releases for other conduct, for things that haven't been investigated, for loan origination, for this shadow registry of mortgages they created called the MERS system. And Bo and I and some other AGs have said we're not given releases for things that haven't been fully investigated. We're not given releases for things that really aren't the subject of the discussions underway.
You are an elected state official, but people call you the sheriff of Wall Street, just as they've called your predecessors in this position. Why is that not a federal position?
Well, we have a very powerful set of securities laws in New York State. The Martin Act actually is probably the strongest securities law in the country, and the New York State Attorney General has a role in regulating what goes on and investigating abuses of the market, and always has. So I think that the term really became popular back when Eliot Spitzer was the AG, and we're in an era where, during the Bush administration, a lot of the federal agencies were slow to police Wall Street. And I think that he sort of filled that gap, and that's where the reputation and the nickname came out. But it's really a traditional role of the office. We have the securities laws. We have an Investor Protection Bureau. And our goal is to make sure that people have confidence that the markets are legitimate and that there's one set of rules for everyone and that if something's rated AAA, that means something.
Well, if you're the sheriff of Wall Street, have the people that you police cleaned up their act since a few years ago?
Well, there have been some changes. I think that, you know, there have been difficulties in implementing the new laws that have been passed by Congress, that the Dodd-Frank laws mired down a little bit in resistance from some folks in Washington to actually moving ahead. But I'm confident that we will get going, and the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau just went into being. So there's a lot of progress that's been made, but we view our investigation as a part of an overall effort to restore the public confidence that is so critical to the functioning of the markets and, frankly, that's so critical to the functioning of our democracy.
There's been a lot of pushback from the big Wall Street firms about Dodd-Frank. They say this has gone way too far. This financial reform is doing things to us that we didn't need to have done to us even after the meltdown in 2008. Are those complaints warranted or not?
Well, there are dozens of issues that are on the table and that still have to be resolved. A lot of this has to do with the rulemaking that has to take place pursuant to the Dodd-Frank reforms. I think in general, the thrust of the reforms were much needed. And look, the markets work well when there's one set of regulations and everyone understands the regulations and everyone plays by the same set of rules. You don't want a situation where the overwhelming majority of the folks in financial services who are good people and just want to make money for themselves and their clients are at a competitive disadvantage with people who really are willing to push the edges of the law and skirt rules. I think deregulation clearly went too far, and I hope that we're able to sort out over the course of the next year or two a new set of rules that everyone can have confidence in. A lot of people out there just think Wall Street's a rigged casino, and we got to move past that if we're going to get the markets moving again and we're going to restore the public confidence that this is a nation where equal justice under law is not just something written over the Supreme Court. It's something that we strive for.
Well, your office looks out over Zuccotti Park and the Occupy Wall Street protesters. What do you make of that movement?
I think that when you cut through a lot of the more flamboyant stuff that gets media attention, what I hear from Occupy Wall Street and the other Occupy movements is really the same thing I hear from most Americans. At the bottom, it's the idea that they're demanding accountability. They have a sense that the banks got bailed out, were holding the bill, and no one was held accountable. And they really want to restore the sense that there's one set of rules for everybody. They most people out there who don't have the inclination, and this is not a Democrat or Republican thing. This is just average New Yorkers. I travel around the state and talk to people in Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse and the suburbs and other parts of the state. And I would say most Americans have lost confidence in our financial services system, have lost confidence and really want to see people held accountable. They want to see meaningful relief for the folks who are injured. And frankly, we want to get the facts all out in public so this never happens again. There are people out there trying to rewrite history and make it sound like this was an earthquake or a natural disaster. It wasn't. This was a man-made catastrophe. We have a spending crisis because the economy blew up. We don't have a spending crisis because of cops and teachers and firefighters who seem to be getting targeted now as the cause of the nation's financial ills. And I see the Occupy movement as just the more visible tip of a big iceberg.
Well, is there anything that you would tell the ordinary people that you speak to as you go here in New York City or other parts of the state or the country that ordinary people don't understand about the way that Wall Street works? Is there anything that you would like to say to people that you don't feel that they know at this point?
Well, we're on the case. I mean, Bo and I and others are investigating this. I think that the regulators, as well as those of us who are prosecutors, have a commitment to ensuring that there is one set of rules, that the markets work for everyone, to make sure that this is a way for people to invest their money, feel safe about it, feel confident about it, and for us to get back to the business of America.
Finally, I want to ask you if you think we'll ever reach a point when we can stop calling plural attorneys general and start saying attorney generals.
The use of language is degenerating so rapidly, you're probably going to see
we'll
that
get
point.
There. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Well, Steve, from Occupy Wall Street to the Occupy protest in Denver, Colorado, the city's mayor asked the demonstrators to elect a leader who could be a contact for police if things get tense or whatever.
Yeah.
And the Denver protesters did oblige by nominating a 3-year-old border collie named Shelby. Now, one supporter explained, Shelby is more of a person than a corporation is and less corrupt than most people.
Wow.
She is the youngest, first, and only dog leader of this revolution.
Goodness.
I think that's probably a safe bet.
It's good for her resume, too.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know,
Japanese camera maker Olympus is reeling now, with stock prices today down to pennies of what they were just a week ago. The company admitted this week to covering up huge losses dating all the way back to the 1980s. Executives reportedly paid inflated fees to advisors as part of the scheme, and the former president and CEO of Olympus, Michael Woodford, who was just fired from the company last month, is with us now to talk about a cover-up he says he knew nothing about. Mr. Woodford, thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning.
You worked for this company for so many years. Why just now raise these questions?
I worked for the company for just over 30 years and was running the European operations of Olympus until April 1st when I was made the president. And that's when I joined the Tokyo board. Knew nothing of any of these issues until an obscure financial journal called Factor published an article at the end of July in Japanese. And I started to have friends and colleagues email me. I was in Europe at the time visiting our German company, saying, hey, look at this. This sounds serious. This very strange allegations against the company's M&A activities of recent years.
Some shareholders are calling for you to come back to the company. Is that a possibility?
It is. I've always said I'd go back. Some of my friends and family members think I'm mad, but I feel an obligation to the 40,000 people who work for the company. After 30 years, you bond with many people, and I don't want to just leave them with the company in this state. It would be the wrong thing to do from a moral stance.
You know, a lot of people say that this financial malfeasance, shall we say, exposes major flaws in Japanese corporate governance. Is this story more than just about Olympus?
It is, and it's opening up. And the Japanese Prime Minister spoke to the Financial Times 10 days ago and said, please don't see Japanese corporations as Olympus is appearing to be. But unfortunately, there are issues, basic issues. There's no remuneration committee. There's no appointments committee in Olympus, which creates a culture of sycophancy and yes men, which you don't want at that level. The non-execs at Olympus, there's two of them. One of them commented to the Wall Street Journal on Saturday that he voted for me to be fired, but he doesn't understand any of the issues discussed at the board meeting. That's what he said. That's the sort of person you have there holding the executive to account. So there are fundamental questions. I think there's also questions in relation to the auditing firms. Both KPMG and Ernst & Young signed the accounts of Olympus off. Now we know for approaching 20 years, these dirty secrets have been hidden. How can we buy bogusly three companies for ludicrous amounts of money? How can we pay bogus payments of $700 million to the Cayman Islands? How can these things happen? So a lot of people have a lot of questions to answer, and the story, I've got no doubt, is going to have many tentacles, which will touch upon all sorts of issues in corporate Japan.
What would you do if you went back to the company? What's the first thing you would do?
I mean, the first thing, you have to cleanse it. Olympus is a great company, but its problem is a sickness at the top. It's a cancer at the top. And all 14 directors have to go. You need new management. Then you need forensic accountants in to establish the integrity of the accounts. And you also need to carry out an impairment test, because the intangible assets, I believe, need to be tested. Once you do that, you can start rebuilding the corporation, which is a leader. For example, in endoscopy, in healthcare, we have 70% of the world market, and it's, you know, life-saving products. So it has to continue, but in a cleansed form, become an example of what a corporate governance should mean in Japan.
The company also makes a lot of cameras. Is there a place in the world for such a company when smartphones seem to be taking their place?
I think that's an entirely different issue to the governance concerns. Olympus is now number one in the micro four thirds category. This is the mirrorless camera category. But consumer electronics is a very tough business. But I think these issues are much more important than that element of the Olympus story. It's the probity and the way companies functions and the way Japan has looked at this story, and the pain and the anguish you have to go through to get it to the point where today the regulatory and enforcement agencies in Japan have now come out very strongly, but it's taken over three weeks since the Financial Times broke this story.
I know the stock value has dropped, has plummeted actually by what, 80%.
That's right.
And Olympus's reputation has taken really a big hit. What happens next to the company?
Again, the company with its 40,000 employees, we make products people want to buy. And particularly in the healthcare and the microscope sectors and the industrial sectors, we are leaders. So the company has a good base. It's a real business. We just need to bring confidence. And the way you will achieve that is by transparency and knowing that the people who are running the company have integrity and honesty. Very basic, very simple things. Then you can have confidence and you can go forward.
Michael Woodford, the former CEO, president and CEO of Olympus, thank you for joining us today.
That's my pleasure.
Talks are set to resume today between owners and players in the NBA, a day after Commissioner David Stern's deadline passed for an agreement. Stern wouldn't give any hints about what that means for hopes of ending the lockout. Weeks of the season, of course, Steve, have already been canceled. And one basketball legend, current Charlotte Bobcats owner, although I think we probably know him more as former Chicago Bulls player Michael Jordan, could end up taking a big hit to his superstar image. Sally Herships explains.
To basketball fans, Michael Jordan is a genuine hero, possibly the greatest player of all time.
A lot of that was certainly due to his determination and focus and leadership on the court.
Kenneth Shropshire is director of Wharton's Sports Business Initiative. He says Jordan took his skills with him when he moved from player to owner. But while Jordan was tough on the court, at the bargaining table, he's seen as ruthless. Wizards player Nick Young even tweeted that he won't wear his Air Jordans anymore.
Michael Jordan always wanted to win at everything, no matter what side of the debate he's on.
Victor Matheson is a sports economist at College of the Holy Cross. He says wherever Jordan is, he's always been known as a tough negotiator, cutting great deals for himself.
As of last year, he was actually still the highest paid basketball player in the world, despite having not played in almost 15 years.
But Matheson says the longer Jordan is away from the game, the harder it will be for him to maintain his brand, especially if players stop wearing his shoes. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Well, we've talked a whole lot, Jeremy, about the remedies Europe came up with to ease the Greek debt crisis. One of them was asking banks to take a so-called haircut on the money Greece owed. You and I have talked about haircuts before in business terms. It's one of those odd terms that we hear. And so I asked Marketplace senior editor and whiteboard guru Patty Hirsch to define the term for me, really get to the nuts and bolts of what haircut really means. He said it would be easier for me, Jeremy, to wrap my head around it if he could drag me out of the office for a hands-on explainer.
Good.
And guess where we wound up.
Welcome to Bolt Barbers, gentlemen. My name is Mohawk Matt, and I'll be your tonsorial specialist today.
Nice to meet you, Matt. Hey, this is a comfy chair.
Hey, Steve, I know we're talking about bonds, but try to stay focused here.
All right, sorry.
So, a haircut. That sounds pretty painless, right?
Sure, I need one myself, actually, Patty. I'm glad you sent us here.
All right, Matt, if I asked you to give Steve a 50% haircut, what would you take that to mean?
I'd say you wanted me to cut off half his hair.
That's okay, I guess. It'll grow back.
Yeah, your hair may grow back, but if you're a German bank getting a haircut on Greek debt, there's no growing back. That hair is gone.
That hair is gone for good?
For good. Look, let me illustrate. Give me $100.
Right now? Here?
Okay, come on, you know. Lend it to me. You know I'm good for it.
Okay, here you go.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh, what? Uh-oh.
Mate, I've run out of cash. I can only pay you 50 back.
What do you mean? You owe me $100?
Yeah, but I can only pay you 50 back.
What about next week?
No, never. You just took a 50% haircut, my friend.
Ouch! That's a 50% haircut?
Yes. So imagine how all the banks that lent Greece about $280 billion are feeling right now.
I would say $140 billion short, I guess.
Yeah, and remember, they're banks who borrow at one rate and then lend at another. So that's $140 billion they owe to other people. So Greece may end up wiping that debt off its books, but that debt still exists. And now the banks have to find a way to pay that money back to their depositors.
And they don't have that kind of money, I'm sure, lying around.
Well, we're not sure. You know, some may not. We're going to have to see how much money those banks have in reserve. And if they don't have enough, then there's a real danger they could start failing, you know, runs on banks, that kind of stuff. And then it could be Lehman Brothers all over again.
That's pretty depressing, Patty.
Yeah, I'm sorry, mate.
Hadn't stopped me, though, from wanting to get my own haircut. Hey, Matt, just 10% off the top?
Why don't we take a little bit off the sides as well?
Oh, no. I don't like that thing.
Marketplace's Patty Hirsch, Mohawk Matt the Barber, and me at Bolt Barbers in downtown Los Angeles. We have a video of my haircut adventure at marketplace.org. Finally, Jeremy, sometimes things just work out for the best. And by best, I mean Best Buy, of course. The electronics retailer was interviewing someone for a job at a store in Pennsylvania. I think it was in the Bethlehem Township. But the manager decided not to hire the 23-year-old. Something told him that that guy just wasn't the right person for the job. Yeah. Turns out, on the very same day of the interview, surveillance cameras caught the job applicant stealing an Xbox system by shoving the game console down his pants. Pretty smart guy, eh? Except, oh yeah, he had just applied for a job at Best Buy. And on that application, Jeremy, what goes on an application?
Oh, your address.
Your address.
Your phone number, all your contact information.
That deserves a
smart
Homer
guy,
Simpson.
Yeah.
Dope!
We need levels of stupid criminal stories that we tell on the show, and I think that's probably like a – yeah, how many dotes is that from Homer?
That could be like three or four. Yeah, well, police arrested him, by the way, just a couple of days after that incident. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So he is done with, that guy. Yeah. Well, in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Thursday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.